Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
The situation inside Israel is moving even faster than it was last year towards the right and towards militarism.
Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. joins us to talk about Afghanistan and Gaza. We'll talk about recent headlines, including a piece by Bradley Burstyn of Haaretz newspaper in Israel. It's titled, "The Looming War in Gaza. Can Obama Stop It Before It Starts?" On our website, talknationradio.org, you can hear an interview with Bradley Burstyn. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., an expert on the Middle East. She directs their new internationalism project. Phyllis Bennis recently updated her best-selling book, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a primer, and that now includes the latest information about the Goldstone Report and other important topics. She's also just released a new book on Afghanistan with longtime colleague David Wildman, and we asked her to talk about the new book.
It's called Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, and it's for obvious reasons. Afghanistan, of course, as we're hearing now from people like Senator Lieberman, Iraq is a war of the past, Afghanistan is the war of the present, and now they're saying Yemen is the war of the future, a deathly prospect, but one that we should keep in mind. And then in the midst of all that, of course, what they don't even have to mention is that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict remains, if not a war, the conflict of forever. So it remains a critical component of how U.S. foreign policy is judged, not only in the Middle East region, but throughout the world.
You've been increasingly critical of President Obama and recently criticized especially his speeches.
Well, there's no doubt that his speech, particularly his Nobel Prize speech, as well as the speech just before that in West Point, where he first articulated his plan for a significant escalation in Afghanistan, have taken a much harsher, more, dare I say, warmongering tone, certainly than candidate Obama did. Candidate Obama, of course, warned us that his policy included escalation in Afghanistan, but he also built his campaign on two points, one of which was, I will end the war in Iraq, and the second was, I will end the mindset that leads to war. And of course, what he's doing instead of ending the mindset that leads to war in Afghanistan, he's implementing the mindset that leads to war. So we have on our hands a very serious challenge, a serious crisis, despite the fact that we knew from the get-go that this was a candidate who understood that if he was going to be taken seriously by powerful interests in the U.S. and be a candidate saying that he was against the war in Iraq, he was going to have to find a war that he could claim as his own. That war is the war in Afghanistan, which some people in the U.S., not everybody, contrary to popular opinion, but some people believed from the beginning was the good war, a just war, a legitimate war, a legal war. In my view, it was none of those things. This was not a war that was legal or authorized or just. This was a war of vengeance. And I don't believe wars of vengeance are ever legal, legitimate, etc. So from the beginning, this was a bad war. But what we're seeing now is a massive escalation that's making the whole thing worse. The cost of this war in Afghan lives, in the lives of U.S. soldiers, the lives of so-called coalition soldiers, is ramping up exponentially. And what we're seeing is that the important social domestic programs that President Obama has staked out some commitment to, issues of jobs, green jobs, health care, education, none of these things are going to be able to go forward because the money is going to end up in the sinkhole of a new quagmire in Afghanistan. He's going to face very much the same challenge that Lyndon Johnson faced in 1964-65 when the goals of the Great Society program, aiming at ending poverty in our lifetime, were smashed on the shoals of the war in Vietnam. This is very much the same tragedy that's about to engulf the Obama administration. But clearly what we're looking at now is a broadly defined policy that looks an awful lot like what George Bush called GWAT, the Global War on Terror. The Obama administration, as soon as they won the election and came into office, announced the end of that term. They made clear that they were not going to use that term. But the reality is, this is what they're doing. They're talking about an endless war without borders that could erupt anywhere. And it's the kind of war that is guaranteed to not make us safer, but to put us at greater risk, to create 2 or 5 or 30 new terrorists for every one that we might kill. These are tactics and strategies that are, in my view, inevitably going to fail. And I think we are facing a very serious problem. On one level, you could look at it and say that what they're doing is playing whack-a-mole. Every time somebody emerges who carries out or tries to carry out an act of terrorism anywhere in the world, that person's country of origin becomes the centerpiece of the next round of this global war on terror. If it's not their country of origin, because that might be a country that we have good ties with, like the UK or Germany perhaps, what we see instead is that the country that maybe that was where they went to get training or where they went to learn how to build a bomb. So we see that with the Christmas Day almost bombing of the Northwest Airlines flight, where we have a Nigerian who happened to get the materials, these chemicals that he was using in Yemen. Now, could he have gotten them anywhere else? Presumably. But as a result, we're going to war, it looks like, against Yemen, because this guy, who wasn't from Yemen, didn't go to school in Yemen, didn't live in Yemen, had gone to Yemen at one point. This is very much the same argument that the Bush administration used when it first went to war against Afghanistan back in 2001. The 9/11 hijackers were not Afghans, not one of them. They didn't live. They were from Saudi Arabia and Egypt, but you can't do anything to those countries because they're close allies of the United States. They didn't live in Afghanistan. They lived in Hamburg. They didn't go to school in Afghanistan. They went to school in Florida. They didn't train and go to flight school in Afghanistan. They went to flight school in Minnesota. So the question of where are we going to war, it could have been Minneapolis. It could have been Miami. It could have been Frankfurt. But it wasn't. It was Afghanistan, because they were inspired by someone who lived in Afghanistan, who also, by the way, wasn't Afghan, but okay. So it's the people of Afghanistan who end up paying the price. And then we at home in this country end up paying a horrific price, both in lives, lives lost and lives destroyed in these wars, and financially, in the jobs that we won't make available, in the schools that will not be able to open, in the healthcare we won't have access to, because hundreds of billions of dollars are being squandered on a useless war, a dangerous war, an illegal war in Afghanistan and Pakistan and maybe now Yemen.
Well, as we learn more about Al-Qaeda in Yemen, it turns out that it's a relatively small presence there. And in terms of the U.S. attacks, you know, much like in Pakistan, drone attacks have alienated some of the leadership there, enraged the civilian population. In Yemen, the Deputy Prime Minister for Security and Defense warned, if there is direct intervention by the U.S., it will strengthen Al-Qaeda.
Well, the drone attacks themselves end up killing civilians. That's the bottom line. The death of civilians breeds terrorism. It gets people so angry when they see their friends, their families, their fellow countrymen, and women and children and old people killed, 20, 30, 40 people killed in order to go after one alleged terrorist. Maybe you get them, maybe you don't, but at what price either way? So, of course, it breeds that. Imagine, and it's so ironic, there's such a strong irony with the role that Yemen has played in U.S. foreign policy in the past. If we go back just 20 years, in 1990, when the U.S., under the first Bush administration, was looking to get unanimity in the UN Security Council to endorse war against Iraq. This is after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, which was, of course, a violation of international law, won immediate and universal condemnation in the Security Council. But it was also not the first time that a Middle Eastern country had invaded and occupied another country. You had Turkey in northern Cyprus. You had Morocco in western Sahara. You had Israel in half the remaining Arab countries. And never before had the U.S. taken the position that this temporary or not occupation had to be placed in the characteristic of war as the basis for a response. This time around, the U.S. said, no, we will go to war. And what we saw was that in the Security Council, only two countries voted no. One was Cuba, that voted no on principle. The other was Yemen, the only Arab country on the council, on the council because it had recently been reunified after 10 years of a crippling civil war. Yemen, clearly the only Arab country, could not vote to endorse a U.S. invasion of another Arab country. Yemen voted no, and no sooner had Abdullah al-Ishtal, the Yemeni ambassador at the time, no sooner had he put down his hand, there was a U.S. diplomat at his side who said, "That will be the most expensive no vote you ever cast." And the remark was picked up on a U.N. microphone and broadcast throughout the building and very quickly around the world. 3 days later, the U.S. made good on the threat and cut the entire U.S. aid budget to Yemen, the poorest country in the Arab world. The aid budget was a pittance. It was only $70 million, nothing relative to what Yemen needed at that time. But that's all the U.S. was giving it, and it was cut, just ended. Imagine if instead of ending the aid program at that time, the U.S. had flooded impoverished Yemen with money for Yemeni civil society to build their own infrastructure, their own schools, their own clinics, in their own image, not in the image of what Blackwater and Halliburton and U.S. contractors want, but to rebuild their own country. Imagine how much less anti-American sentiment there would be in Yemen right now, when what we're seeing now is not only is the U.S. desperately trying to catch up after years of abandoning Yemen, but the only aid it seems to be sending is military aid, security aid, covert operations, sending Marines, sending weapons, instead of sending food and doctors and clinics. That's been the problem of U.S. policy all along.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio, and we're speaking with Phyllis Bennis of IPS, the Institute for Policy Studies. We were also able to reach journalist Bradley Burstyn of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, and we'll upload that interview with Burstyn early to talknationradio.org so that you might hear his thoughts about his recent story in Haaretz titled, "The Looming War in Gaza. Can Obama Stop It Before It Starts?" Now, in that piece, he quotes Yom Tov Samia, former overall Israeli military commander of the Gaza Strip and the adjacent Negev, Samia offering what Burstyn called a coolly terrifying analysis, one that led the journalist to believe that there is a potential for a second attack on Gaza by Israel and soon. Burstyn adding that history has taught observers of this region that, quote, a future war becomes practically inevitable the moment a key IDF reserve major general declares it so.
Well, I think what it is something of a lobbying campaign by some retired generals who still nurse the feeling that it's possible to affect a regime change in Gaza and to essentially do some sort of tremendous damage to Hamas.
We asked Phyllis Bennis to comment on what Bradley Burstyn had said in his piece about a possible second Gaza war.
The situation inside Israel is moving even faster than it was last year towards the right and towards militarism. The war in Gaza and its aftermath have essentially brought the demise of all of the parties in the Israeli Knesset among Israeli Jews, not so much the Israeli Arab parties, but among the Israeli Jewish parties, parties like Meretz and Labor that were centrist and center-left. Meretz, the farthest to the left of any existing party in the Knesset, in the parliament, have really lost their influence. And the rush to the right is a powerful thing that's underway. Israel is one of the countries of the developing world that is doing the best economically through this economic crisis. Their tourism industry is booming. Their high-tech sector is booming. And Israelis as individuals are basically doing great. And that's why it's a very dangerous moment, because the current situation could indeed, from the Israeli vantage point, last a pretty long time. And they would be pretty happy with it, because as long as the Palestinians are not resisting militarily, the only thing that is challenging the Israeli occupation and Israeli apartheid policies, and crucially the siege of Gaza, is not anything that U.S. or other international pressure is doing at the governmental level. The only thing pressuring them is the civil society mobilization now underway in the U.S. and all around the world of what is known as BDS, Boycotts, Divestment, and Sanctions, led by, in the U.S., it's the giant coalition called the U.S. Campaign to End Israeli Occupation that is working to build the BDS movement in concert with our colleagues around the rest of the world. So that's something that Israel is taking very seriously. But there's no question that so far we've seen no indication that the Obama administration is prepared to actually use this pressure that was hinted at by Senator Mitchell. It was a major step forward that Senator Mitchell even hinted that the possibility of cutting back in the billions of dollars of loan guarantees that the U.S. gives to Israel every year might be an option. I think he was floating it as a trial balloon aimed at Congress, and Congress predictably responded, you will not cut any aid to Israel. The reality is that the Obama administration, within days after taking office, had agreed to implement the Bush-initiated agreement to provide Israel with $30 billion, not in loan guarantees, but in direct military aid over the next 10 years. $30 billion in the kinds of weapons that Israel used in the Gaza war, in complete violation of international law, as well as U.S. law, the Arms Export Control Act, that is supposed to narrowly define how a recipient country can use U.S. arms. So in that context, the announcement that the U.S. is going to provide Israel with $800 million more in military equipment, which won't officially be considered part of their military aid because it officially will remain in U.S. custody, but it will be stockpiled on Israeli land. And crucially, according to Defense News, Israel will be allowed to use the U.S. ordnance in the event of a military emergency. Now, the problem is when you have Israeli generals getting to decide for themselves what's a military emergency, you have a real problem on your hand where you have $800 million worth of arms belonging to the U.S., but with the deal being that the Israelis can use it whenever they want. And these, we're talking about missiles, armored cars, armored vehicles, aerial ammunition, artillery, all the things that were used in the Gaza war. We haven't heard yet whether things like cluster bombs or white phosphorus munitions were included as well. It's certainly possible. So this raises a very serious question of U.S. complicity in the possibility of future Israeli war crimes.
We've also heard from social worker Ridgely Fuller, who has been on the show, that people in Palestine have been extremely upset because of settlers who are more and more aggressive, and they've been threatening or even attacking Palestinians. And then on Christmas Eve, settlers spray-painted "Death to All Arabs" or price tag on Palestinian property. You know, this as bulldozers are razing more Palestinian homes so that the new settlements can be built. Meanwhile, Israeli troops in the region apparently do nothing in response to pleas from Palestinians or their advocates. So this has been an increase in what could only be called provocations, you know, on the part of Israel and settlers.
Yeah, this has been a very serious situation because we have the Obama administration early on this year requesting a complete settlement freeze. That means a complete freeze in all settlement activities in all settlements, which is what Israel, ironically enough, had agreed to several years ago but never implemented. Obama came into office and said, we would like Israel to implement a complete settlement freeze. Israel said no, and Obama repeated, we would like a complete settlement freeze. No. Well, how about a settlement freeze for just a few months? No. Well, how about a settlement freeze that excludes occupied East Jerusalem, allows complete settlement there, and is only a partial settlement everywhere else? Maybe. No. So this was the answer, and then eventually the Obama administration stopped requesting. And the Israelis unilaterally a few weeks ago announced what they considered a partial settlement freeze, which was greeted with great joy by the Obama administration, including Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who called it an unprecedented act. But in fact, it's a fraud. Israel agreed that they would freeze settlements, except that they would continue building the 3,000 new settlement units that they had already agreed to build, except that all building in occupied East Jerusalem was going to go on apace, and except for the fact that the whole thing was going to only last some months, and except for the fact that they already announced to the settlers that as soon as the so-called freeze was over, they would expedite an even faster rate of settlement growth. So the whole thing has been a fraud. but there has been no accountability for it, and particularly, we've never seen the Obama administration take seriously their own capacity to use the issue of the $30 billion in military aid that President Obama agreed to provide to Israel as a kind of pressure to say, listen, you need to freeze settlements, because all the settlements in Jerusalem, in the big settlement blocks, all of them are illegal, period, full stop. And you need to freeze them. That's hardly something. I mean, that's really the equivalent of telling a gang of bank robbers that you need to stop robbing banks for a few months. Presumably after that, you can go back to robbing banks. But we need you to stop robbing banks or building settlements for just a few months. And if you don't, you know that $30 billion we promised you? You can kiss that goodbye. Or at least you can kiss goodbye this year's component of that. I mean, they had a huge capacity for changing the discourse in terms of putting real pressure on Israel. They chose not to do it. That's a very sad reality that we're seeing the results of right now. There is no ability of the Obama administration to claim that the, quote, peace process is underway. They said from the beginning that this was going to be priority number one from day one, and instead we've seen it sidelined again and again as Israeli rejectionism has been accepted and embraced by the United States. We saw it again with the Goldstone Report, the very important UN fact-finding mission that determined that war crimes and possibly crimes against humanity had indeed been committed in Gaza by Israel and perhaps by Palestinian armed groups as well, called for internal investigations by both sides and said if they don't do it to an international standard, the Security Council should pass the charges on to the International Criminal Court so there can be some real accountability. The U.S. position from the beginning has been to accept the Israeli rejection of the Goldstone Report, demeaning it, demeaning Justice Goldstone himself, as difficult as that is, given his own credentials. And the result has been that the U.S. is isolated once again with Israel as its only ally slash agent, perhaps, in refusing to acknowledge the significance of the Goldstone Report. What we're seeing now is an effort by the U.S., I think his title is Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, Michael Posner, in a letter that he sent to Israeli officials indicating that the U.S. would like to help Israel bury the Goldstone Report by encouraging them to go through some independent process. It wasn't a situation where he said, the Goldstone Report appropriately calls on you, Israel, to investigate your own potential culpability in war crimes, and therefore you should do it. They said, we want to help you eliminate the influence of the Goldstone Report, and the best way to do that is for you to carry out what looks like a credible report. It's a terrible, cynical use of international law.
This delegation of more than 1,000 people, some said it was more like 1,300, trying to get into Gaza, instead a very sobering experience on the streets of Cairo, the Egyptian government refusing to let them pass, and so then sweeping in on them. They were protesting peacefully, but they got very badly roughed up. They were kicked, thrown to the ground, and Egyptian riot police overreacting, detaining people on the sidewalk.
It's been a very sobering experience for everyone associated with the Gaza Freedom March or with the Viva Palestina aid convoy, and, of course, for the Palestinians inside Gaza who were allied with both of those mobilizations, who, you know, were trying to have a peaceful march inside Gaza. But, you know, they were not allowed to have their internationals come to join them. It's true, the Egyptians in this situation were acting clearly in the interests of the United States and Israel. The building of the giant new iron wall that Egypt is building on its border with Gaza, which is sinking iron plates into the earth to block off the tunnels, this is going to create a even more massive humanitarian crisis in Gaza because it's only through the tunnels, hundreds of them, that basic foodstuffs, books, school supplies, computers, cows, cement, what little bit of rebuilding equipment has been able to get into Gaza, has come through these smuggling tunnels because virtually nothing is allowed in by the Israeli crossings. And in that context, Egypt is doing the work of the Israeli occupation at the behest, no doubt, of the United States. The United States, of course, provides several billion dollars a year in aid to Egypt. It's third after Israel as a recipient of U.S. military and economic aid, and is very dependent on remaining in the U.S. good graces. So what Egypt is doing has to be looked at not just in the context of Egypt as a police state, which we certainly saw at a certain level here, but Egypt as doing the bidding of the occupying forces. That's unfortunately very much the role that they were playing in refusing to allow the internationals in. It's much more important for what it says about their position vis-a-vis Gaza and Palestine than it is relative to what happened to the individuals who were indeed roughed up, some of them quite badly. And that has to be seen in the context of what the consequences of the siege are all about. The siege means inside Gaza you have a population of 1.5 million people who are surviving almost entirely, the entire population, on less than $2 a day. Israel has bragged about their allowing in on occasion up to even 100 trucks on some days, truckloads of the 40 items of basic foodstuffs that have been deemed sufficiently basic to stave off starvation. This in a situation where, for example, a truckload of pasta was not allowed in because pasta was considered a luxury. Only rice was considered a basic necessity. So the pasta was turned away, and the cry, "Free the macaroni," became the rallying cry of the day. But the result is that children are facing the problem of stunting because of the lack of sufficient food. Parts for the water treatment plant cannot be obtained, so the water is increasingly not only salinated, it's not only too salty, but it's now being contaminated with waste because there is no serious treatment available. Medicines are in short supply. It's a disastrous situation for the people of Gaza. And it was that situation that the internationals wanted to bring back to their respective countries. They were there from 43 countries. And the goal was to bring back that information about what it means for the people of Gaza to live under these conditions. Unfortunately, the vast majority of them were not allowed in to see, but they certainly learned enough in the time they spent there that what's so important now is that those young people are coming back with all of this energy to talk to other people, to write letters to the editor, push their members of Congress, do all the mobilizing things that will be so important, building the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement. All of that will be the important aftermath of the Gaza Freedom March.
We'll hear more analysis from Phyllis Bennis on Hamas rockets into Israel next time.
All they needed to do instead of going to war was to return to the ceasefire, which they had broken dramatically on November 4th, 2008, before their invasion and attack, when they launched a massive set of airstrikes in Gaza, killing 6 Palestinians. That was what brought the ceasefire to an end.
Phyllis Bennis is author of many books on the Middle East, including her just released Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer. Bennis has also recently updated her 2007 book, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict. And we'll also be joined by Bradley Burstyn of Haaretz newspaper in Israel to discuss the potential for a second Israeli attack on Gaza.
You'll be able to tell in the next few days how it's going. If rockets are fired on the one hand, and if the Israeli Air Force attacks sites in Gaza on the other, then this buildup toward a possible conflagration may continue. You'll see it in the news if it's happening.
This as Hamas has said they don't want al-Qaeda in Gaza and are working to keep them out. You can learn more about this crisis January 27th at Yale University's Luce Hall, 34 Hillcrest Avenue, New Haven, at a 4 p.m. talk by Judge Richard Goldstone on accountability for war crimes. The program is free and open to the public. Also, the New England Anti-War Conference will be held on Saturday, January 30th, from 10:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. at MIT Building 34101, 50 Vassar Street, Cambridge, Mass. You can register online at newenglandunited.org or call David at 508-653-5534 for information. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio downloads, and discussion, and we'll put up the list of agencies you can contact to make donations to help Haiti on our website and on our blog.